Blog Talk Radio.
Paula Thompson, and with me is my dear friend and co-host, Andre Rodatis. Hi, Andre.
Well, hi, Paula.
How are you this morning?
Well, I'm doing just fine, and I was just speaking with our guest.
Oh, you were? Okay.
I was.
Well, she hasn't called
and
me yet, but... Well,
she has actually about three times, and apparently it's because it's GChat, it may be showing up as a different area code. So you may want to pull up a different looking area code than the one that I had given you.
Okay.
So
well,
and
only...
it should be coming in right now.
Okay, great. We'll see. We'll see what happens here. We are we're going to be speaking to very directly here. Ms. Angie Thurston, and Angie is one of the most brilliant and beautiful young women I know, but also one of the most accomplished, and she's just a dynamo, and we're so happy to have her on today. I'm still waiting for her to call in, so any moment now, we're hoping that Angie will give us a call.
And this is a perfect opportunity to talk about her while she's not on the line, so she can't say anything about it. You know, you took those words right out of my mouth. Every time, I mean, seriously, yesterday as I was writing up a blurb and everything else, that's the first word that came to me is the one you just used, and that is dynamo. This is energy personified and energy applied to so many wonderful and good projects. If you look at, you know, some of the things that Angie is involved in, she's a second generation reader. She grew up in a Urantian family. She's entering Harvard Divinity School in the fall to pursue a Master of Divinity degree. Her intent is to help develop empowering a community among the growing numbers of people, especially young people, who in our culture are identifying as spiritual but not religious, because religious is so often associated with organized religion or authoritative religion in that pejorative sense for a lot of people. Not that there's anything wrong with it. I don't have an opinion on it as being, you know, positive or negative, but it is often experienced by people as being negative. And she's interested in working with people that have opted to pursue a more personal spiritual experience. She's a playwright. She has a degree from Brown University. She's currently writing a new play for families called The Story of Ruth, based on the story of Jesus' baby sister in the Urantia book. She hopes it will premiere at IC14. Mm-hmm. She's the conference chair for IC14. She's a member of the Fellowship's General Council. She's a founding member of the Youth and Young Adult Committee. She's been working on that committee for the past 3 years, and she encourages everyone to attend that next conference that's coming up. And it seems that she has her hands in a lot of very important projects, and important not in the sense that they are self-importance making. They're important in the kind of service that she's doing. So I'm taking it that you don't see...
Well, I see a caller 720. Angie, is it you?
Yes, it is.
Hey, it is you, Angie. I'm so glad.
Look at that. We got to talk about you without you being able to say a word about it.
Thank you.
The magic of modern
technology. Well,
welcome
to the Cosmic Citizen, Angie. It's marvelous to have you on.
Yes, indeed.
And we're very, very pleased to have you here.
And the one thing that, Andre, that you didn't mention that I will mention is that, well, a couple things. Angie grew up in our community in Boulder. When you and your mom and dad first came to Boulder with your little brother and little sister, you always struck me as such a remarkable young woman, and so engaged, so enthused about living, so there and present and just doing everything you could do. I remember you practicing on your practice keyboard and a remarkable student. Your mom and dad are remarkable parents, actually, and I was always gratified to know you and your family growing up, and the quintessential big sister. I mean, what a role model for your younger siblings you always were. And and also I'd like to point out that you just did a successful fundraiser to raise money for this play that you're doing. So my hat's off to you, Angie Thurston. You're one of my heroes. Thank you for being on our show.
Oh my goodness. Well, I feel the same way about you, Paula. It's really a pleasure to be speaking with both of you, both of whom were part of my childhood and my upbringing, and I'm so lucky to continue to have both of you in my community. Even when we're separated by distance geographically, that we're always united in spirit, and that I know that you two are both doing such wonderful work as well. So thank you for this chance to have a conversation.
Well, thank you for getting involved with us. I mean, I think I can speak for everyone in the fellowship, the Urantia Book Fellowship, who knows you and has worked with you in any capacity. We're all so deeply, deeply grateful that you decided to get involved with the Urantia movement, and because that, obviously that doesn't happen every day with young readers and second-generation readers like you. What do you think that is, Angie? Can I ask you that? What made you decide to get involved?
Yeah, that's a great question. Well, and I do think it goes back to my roots in a lot of ways. I was really, really blessed to grow up in a home where my parents were actively striving to live the teachings and to raise me and my two younger siblings with those teachings as an integral part of our lives, not only that the Urantia book was in the house and that it was understood that my parents were deeply invested in studying it and understanding it, but also that they were deeply committed to living it. So that was really valuable to grow up experiencing. And then I had the added benefit of growing up. My first 8 years were spent in San Francisco, and then the next 10 years after that were spent in Boulder. And those were both really vibrant communities where I was surrounded by other families who were committed to living the teachings of the book as well. So that was something that I had the pretty rare experience of being the norm. It was kind of something that I was able to take for granted. Not to say that I wasn't aware that this community was quite small. You know, I was still going to school, and I didn't have any friends in school or anything who knew about the Urantia book, but I had a really solid foundation. And then ultimately, what was really wonderful about that is that it gave me this foundation that I could then come out of and go to college and go pursue my interests with the awareness of, you know, I could know that the Urantia book and its teachings were something integral to my family life and my community life, and then make a decision on my own as to whether I also believed these teachings. And that was something that I don't think I really came to fully until adulthood. And it wasn't until I had really gotten through college that I reassessed, you know, what is my relationship to both this text and the community of people who study it and are really basing their understanding of life and of the world on its teachings. And I kind of recommitted to making that personal decision on my own and that personal discovery. And that was in my early 20s. And I strive to always maintain a similar relationship to the book as I did during that time, just in that I was approaching every paragraph and every paper with what I would hope to be a healthy degree of skepticism, you know, to really examine it and think and feel, is this resonant? Is this striking a chord? And again and again, for me, the answer was and continues to be yes. And once I made that personal discovery, then the next step was, well, if that's what I believe, then what am I going to do about it? And my involvement in the community since then has essentially been the first steps of trying to answer that question.
Fantastic.
You know, I resonate with that so much. You know, I was myself, you know, a teenager when I found the book, and it's funny how at some point you realize, okay, well, first of all, there's a parallel in both aspects that you shared, which is I just want to share briefly. I had the experience of, okay, I tend to be a person that easily will, you know, follow the truth wherever it goes. Some people may call that credulous. I just call it open. You know?
Right.
But as I was reading and I think it was the author's very wise choice to choose names like Divine Counselor and Mighty Messenger and names like that, which definitely add credibility, right? You know, they may as well have said Mighty Mouse, you know, because that's not a selling point exactly.
Right.
So I was intrigued from the standpoint that, okay, nobody would do this if they were trying to win people through some kind of surreptitious means. They wouldn't put things in like Mighty Messenger and Divine Counselor as author names. That's not going to do it. So I decided, at some point, so much was resonating. I said, I've got to pull back a bit, and I'm going to have an artificially skeptical attitude here. I'm going to look for problems. I'm going to make sure to be aware that there may be inconsistencies and see if I can find them. And I kept reading, and they just didn't come up. I mean, there was the one thing that looked like an apparent inconsistency regarding trait determiners, which, you know, one is wont to think in terms of chromosomes, but no, they say there's 48 trait determiners, you know, 24 pairs of trait determiners. And, you know, different things like that, but there was nothing major. So between that and then the idea that when I got to the point, it was like something like 863 or 867, you know, in my sequential reading where I would bounce around, and all of a sudden I realized, okay, the artificially skeptical attitude is not important anymore. It is too internally consistent. Okay, I'll still look for stuff, but I know the book is what it says it is. Now what am I going to do about it?
Yeah.
And that question that comes up in mind, it's like they're ready. They have the educational program going in the background, and they're ready for us. And there was a question that I'll stop with this because this is about you, not about me. Although people are going to start to wonder in a minute. But see if you resonate with this. At one point, I had a thought, and I realized if I don't make a decision about this book, and this was like right almost exactly on my 18th birthday, if I don't make a decision about this book today, it may be 30 years before I do so. Mm-hmm. That was just like clear front and center in front of me. I decided, okay, this is for me. I'm committed, and I'll follow this wherever it leads, and went on from there. Anyway, that just sparked that for me. So thank you.
Absolutely. Well, it's very much resonant what you said, and I think, you know, I had the experience of knowing that this was what both of my parents believed, you know, and many people, regardless of what the particulars of their parents' belief systems or lack thereof may be, I think often find that that's the first point at which they have to either accept or reject, you know, agree or disagree, but you're presented with something. And I had an extraordinary situation where this is what I was presented with. And so, you know, it could have been something else that I was in the position of assessing. And as it turned out, it was the Ranch book, which, you know, I think about sometimes in light of the fact that so many people of my parents' generation and the generation before had the experience of that deep hunger for truth and just the remarkable moment of discovery of the Ranch book and the truths contained therein. And in many ways, I did have that experience, but I had that experience over time with the built-in, not assumption, but at least hypothesis that the Ranch book was this revealed source of truth. As opposed to really having no idea, you know, and searching everywhere. And it's interesting just in light of the emphasis that the Ranch book places on experience and the value of experience. That's something that I sometimes joke about with my parents and others who are older than me, just because as much as I have been so blessed to have this revelation handed to me from the time I was born, you know, what I missed was the experience of being completely lost, and then that moment of discovery that so many, even of course in my generation, you know, people who didn't grow up with the book and who found it in other ways. I mean, the stories are just so unbelievable of the lengths that people will go in their searching. So that's part of where I think I also feel a joyful sense of responsibility, you know, that I have a really remarkable opportunity here, given that I've had this sort of incomparable tool for as long as I can remember, and that I'm in a position at a relatively young age to try to leverage that as best as I can to be of service.
You went through the book for the very first time as a teenager with Larry Mullins and his daughter Michelle, right, in a young readers group?
That's right, yes. My younger brother and sister and I would go and have study group with the Mullins and Michelle Mullins, who's about my age, and Larry and Joan, and we went through the book. Now, I left for college before we finished. I think my brother and sister definitely got farther along, so I had to do some catch-up later on. But we would go sequentially, and that was another really valuable chapter in my upbringing, mm-hmm. because there was a lot of autonomy given to the young folks, and that was true in my family as well. But the onus was really on us. Every week, there was a different one of the kids who was responsible for being the leader of the study group.
Wow.
And we were responsible for picking a quote that we wanted to open with and for saying an opening prayer. And then we got to designate who was going to read first. And, you know, we kind of developed a little tradition, and that was often the case in my family, too. We had family meetings every Sunday. And from a young, young age, we would pick a quote, but these were talking like one sentence max, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And
right.
I remember one in particular was, "The universe is not an accident." And, you know, then that was a point of discussion for the family. And we would talk about what we were thankful for that week and things. So from the family, that sort of expanded into that study group with the Mullins, and that nurtured me all the way up until I left for college. So that was definitely very influential in terms of realizing that even though this is a pretty daunting-looking book and a lot of the language in it is no less daunting, that even as young adults, we were empowered to approach it and to embrace it and to have mentors who would help guide us through it and really respect our questions and treat them as at least valid, and then, you know,
right.
sometimes even acknowledge that they didn't know the answers either.
Yeah, you know, that strikes me as so powerful. When you're in it, it can seem like it's so simple and natural. And yet, looking back on it, or looking at it from the outside, and especially in the context of the world today, it's such a powerful and different kind of enculturation. Just the idea of being stimulated to think about something, you know, some simple, positive, important philosophical ideas like that, like, you know, the world and the universe are not accidents, or having the study group culture. I had the experience of being in Larry and Joan's Living the Teachings meeting, where it was essentially a sharing group where we would share our spiritual walk with God, and it was around being Urantia Book readers for a lot of us, though there were some non-readers that were participating. So I mention it because during that, from time to time, I remember Larry mentioning, you know, saying, you know, what it was like, you know, watching you guys study the book. And
oh, wow.
Said, you know, these guys, you know, they're in charge. They're taking it. They're coming up with these wonderful questions, and he was often saying, you know, these guys, they're more powerful than the adults. They're taking off with this. I, you know, this is where our future is, you know, because of how dynamically you were studying the book and what kind of energy you were bringing to it, and what kind of seriousness in the sense of You were really sincerely questioning, was the sense that he got. And I also got the sense from how he said it, and you seem to be corroborating that as you're describing it, is that it was really hands-off on the parts of the adults. This was not, you know, adults trying to brainwash you.
Mm-hmm.
Th- this was adults trying to let you have your own experience. Am I right in that?
Absolutely. And with the addition that it was just a very nurturing and consistent part of our lives.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it was hands-off in that no one was lecturing to us. And they
right.
created a structure in which we were empowered and, in fact, on some level required. You know, that was part of the premise of the weekly study group, was that it was the expectation that we, as this younger generation, would take on just these small levels of responsibility when it came to our weekly study, and that, you know, it was expected that we show up every week and that we participate actively, but it was never presented to us rigidly in terms of anything like an expectation that we would believe what we were reading, for instance. You know, there was never, and I think that's something that there's sometimes concern about from one generation to the next. I think especially when people have come to the Urantia Book out of other religious traditions where they did feel like perhaps something was forced upon them in some way, or that they were required to believe what was handed to them, or else there would be a set of consequences, you know. And that was what was lovely about this experience, at least for me, was that it was very clear that out of love, these two families wanted to make sure that we had an opportunity to have this presented to us in a way that we could engage with deeply and make our own decision. And, you know, I remember my little sister she had to join us from a very young age, you know, and there was a whole period where she definitely didn't want to come sit on the couch and read the Urantia Book, you know, and that was fine. There were plenty of other things to do with the house.
Haley at that point? She must have been very young at that point.
She must have been very young. She's 6 years younger than me. So, you know, but in fact, at least my experience of it, and you would have to ask her how it felt to her, but it always seemed to me like the adults kind of respected the fact that she was taking a stand, even though she was so young. Just that she, you know, she was like, this is not what I feel inclined to do. And then at a certain point, she made a decision that she wanted to participate, and that was her decision. But it was very much a dynamic that I would recommend, you know. I found it personally to be effective and empowering while also feeling safe. You know, it felt like the adults there were looking out for us, and, you know, it was hands off in that they weren't making any exacting demands or being specific in what we should think or feel. But they were also hands-on in that they were very active in doing their best to help us arrive at an understanding. And that went even beyond the reading. I think Larry and Joan are still working on the Chronicles, which was they presented the times of Jesus and the story of his life and teachings in a news format. And so that was one of the projects they were working on. You know, just various endeavors to help elucidate the teachings as much as possible. That was also an ongoing effort there. So I was very lucky.
You know, something you've said reminds me of a great quote from Paper 100, Religion and Human Experience. It's in the very first section, paragraph 3. It says, give every developing child a chance to grow his own religious experience. Do not force a ready-made adult experience upon him. And, you know, I know a lot of readers who would cite that and say, see, therefore, you know, we shouldn't have young people involved in study group because we're forcing a ready-made adult experience upon them. And talking to you and to one of your biggest fans and one of my favorite people, my daughter May, who also attends a young people study group hosted by Jen Siegel, And it has made a difference in her life, and she loves it because all of a sudden it's not just a strange thing that my mom and dad do or that my mom does or whatever. It's something that I understand too. It's a part of who I am as well. And she gets it, and you know, she sees that in you, I think. And I think that this quote is misunderstood oftentimes, because what you just described for me is that you can help a child discover a great religious truth. You can't dictate to them whether or not they believe it.
Right.
And I think that's the difference, to not expose them to a spiritual teaching of this magnitude is a grave error, I think. To say, well, if they're led to it, they'll find it eventually or whatever, just like I did. Well, maybe and maybe not, but at least give them a chance to say, that makes sense to me, or I like that, or nah, it's not my cup of tea, you know.
Right.
But don't just completely ignore, you know, their maybe ability to understand it and to enjoy it, and give them that opportunity to try.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm glad. My hat's off to Larry Mullins and Joan Mullins for doing it. And I remember I also remember that John Hay did a teenagers group with the Kruger Boys and several teenagers, and they actually listened to the cassette tapes. And they would read along. They listened at that time. It was Merritt's reading on cassette tapes, and they would play a tape, and then they would discuss, and they would play a little more and discuss. And he went through the book with a group of teenagers that way as well. And it's a good. It's an enriching thing. I think any time, and you're about to get your divinity degree, and any time you read inspired literature, that's not a bad thing. Where it
right.
goes off the rails is when somebody interprets it for you and tells you that you can't see it in any other way except the way they interpret it. That's not a good thing. But right. when you read an inspired writing, and for me it's, you know, beautiful words on a page are the most thrilling things that have ever happened to me, in terms of personal religious experience, poems and religious writings, insightful words, prose, quotable quotes, I don't care what they are. They thrill me to the marrow. If they resonate, if they ring the gong in my soul, if they ring the truth bell, I'm down with that. And I think that one of the, I mean, I love poetry all my life, but one of the first things that did that to me in a huge way was when I was 16. It was before I found the Urantia book. I was 20. I read the Desiderata. And it was the most profound philosophy I've ever seen up to that point, and it just rang a bell in my soul, and I knew this is true. And I loved it. I even used it I was a speaker at my graduation, and I used it, and people will resonate with truth. Children and all kinds of people, no matter how old they are.
Right.
You know, if you expose them to it.
Well, for the record, I am one of your daughter's biggest fans as well, Paul.
Well, you two have a mutual admiration society, and it was wonderful to see the young people at the conference just last week, to see how you guys are bonding and how you love each other, and you just give me so much hope for the future. And maybe you can tell us a little bit about yourself, Angie. How old are you, and what's your education? I mean, we know now you grew up where you grew up, and that you read the book as a teenager. But
sure. Well, I missed a little bit of Andre's introduction, so I'll try not to be too redundant. But I am 28 years old, and after my time in Boulder going through high school, I then went to Brown University in Rhode Island, and I got a degree in literary arts, and my focus was on playwriting. And Brown has this sort of notorious open curriculum where you have very few requirements. They have no distribution requirements, and therefore you have both the opportunity to really take your education into your own hands and the opportunity to make mistakes along the way. So I, for instance, I think I took 11 or 12 playwriting classes while I was at Brown, which was extraordinary as an opportunity. I also, in retrospect, maybe would have diversified a little bit. But I got a very in-depth education in that particular area, and, you know, we can talk a little bit more about that in terms of the play I'm writing now. But I not only got to write in college, I also got to produce some of the plays that I was writing, which was really, really exciting. And it's how I realized that that's, at least so far, my favorite art form to work in. I was always kind of an artsy kid, did a lot of acting and music stuff growing up and visual art as well. But what I discovered about playwriting and what I found I love so much about it was that it didn't actually exist until it became collaborative. You know, I can sit and write words on a page, and that could be somewhat edifying for someone reading them. But to have the experience of people's creativity being applied to what's on the page and then bringing it to life with all the different skills that they bring to the table, be that acting, be it directing, be it set designing, lighting design, you know, there's so many different skills that are necessary in order to bring a work of theater to life. And I just found it to be really extraordinary the first time I was able to be part of the production of a play that I had written, and very humbling just to see what people bring to it, and that it really, by necessity, is a collaborative undertaking, and that what you create doesn't belong to any one person, you know, and in some ways it doesn't even belong to the group who created it, because then you share it with an audience, you know, and so that sense of attachment that you can have in writing a play immediately has to go out the window because you're giving it over to a group, and then that group is, depending on the future of it, you know, is ever expanding as it gets shared with more audiences and if it's taken on by more companies and casts. And so I really love that about playwriting, and it was part of why I think I got hooked on it in college. And then I moved to New York City after college, and that was very much related to my interest in playwriting, given that New York is such a theater hub. But it was also just part of my DNA. I think I've always been a city kid. And so I kind of fell in love with Brooklyn, and that's where I've lived for the last 6 years. And I've been working in the arts, but I've been working in a staff capacity. I worked at Manhattan School of Music, which is a conservatory up in Morningside Heights in Manhattan. And I did that for a few years, and then I decided that I wanted to pursue something that would be more, maybe this was related to that same impulse that led me to playwriting. I love things that are collaborative and that create community. And so I managed to find a job at an arts nonprofit in Brooklyn that puts on a free performing arts festival in Prospect Park. And it's a really, really wonderful program, and the venue holds between 6,000 and 7,000 people. So from night to night to night, for 30 nights out of the summer, you have every kind of music celebrating every kind of community. You know, it's from reggae to bluegrass to gospel to the, you know, family concert to indie rock to you name it. They've got all kinds of artists coming. They show movies, and it's free, and so you get just an extraordinary cross-section of the community. And in a lot of ways, I see that as what the stepping stone that got me now to this point of applying to Divinity School, because the satisfaction I find from helping to facilitate opportunities for people to come together and make mutual discoveries, that was something that definitely excited me about the arts and continues to, be that playwriting or be that putting on events. And now I want to move that into the realm of spirituality and religion, and that's what's bringing me next year to Harvard. So I'm going to be in a 3-year program, a Master of Divinity program, and that's the next chapter. So
what I hear from what you're saying is there's this marvelous collaborative effort that occurs in playwriting, and it almost sounds like if I understand you correctly, what comes to mind for me is that a playwright is very analogous almost to being an architect. An architect without clients can make many beautiful buildings in design, but that's not what an architect becomes an architect for. They want to see the building. They want to see something standing.
Play is a lot like a blueprint.
Yes, exactly. And then it struck me that there's almost a vehicular aspect that you've come to realize about that. Okay, so when this collaborative effort is happening, it seems to you that, do I hear you correctly, that this becomes a wonderful vehicle for expressing any number of, well, personal expressions for sure, which is what any playwright is going to be doing. But what I hear you saying is that with a view to higher value and a desire to bring people to realize higher values, that it becomes a vehicle for exposing people to higher values and getting to think about it.
Right. Well, and it's exposure by experience. That's my favorite thing about it, is that, you know, some of the best experiences I've had in being part of creative undertakings, whether that's a play or a concert, or even, you know, I would consider this conference planning to be a creative undertaking as well.
Mm-hmm.
These efforts create relationships, you know, and of course we know from the Urantia book that it's through our relationships with each other that we discover God, and the unique expression of God that each person brings is something that you really experience when you're working together on something that is meaningful to both of you. And that's, of course, true in any undertaking, you know, outside of the arts as well. But when there is that kind of culminating point, you know, when you're really working toward, whether it's a production of a play or a conference that's going to happen and people are going to come to it, or a concert that's going to bring a whole bunch of people together from a whole bunch of different parts of the community, you know, that to share that intention and to work toward it together and apply your different talents and your different perspectives to that effort, to me is one of the ways that you can really experience living your values, because there's just an intent to be of service, and in the process, of course, you know, such things typically aren't easy. There's usually a lot of navigating you have to do along the way, and people have different perspectives and different visions, and you have to figure out how to work together. But it, you know, at least from the perspective of the Urantia book, it seems to me that that's one of the most valuable things we can do, is to learn how to engage our differences and our glorious diversity in order to get things done. And and then, you know, there's that journey. And I was just reading in one of the papers about Infinity, you know, and they talk about how infinity can be totaled at any point, and that point is the sweet experience of goal completion for us. You know, we aspire and aspire, and then we attain a goal, and for a moment we have that rest and that joy, and then we come up with an even bigger goal, and then we work toward that. But it's just so much sweeter to have that sense of goal attainment with others. You know, when you've really worked with a group and managed to create something together, I think that's a really powerful experience. So I intend to keep collaborating.
Go ahead, Paula.
Well, I just wanted to say, you know, in the vein of what you were talking about, writing a play, which, and you can maybe tell us a little bit about this play and what you hope to accomplish in terms of what's the message of the play for our listeners. But because I think I've heard it, and I think Andre probably has, but of course we want you to expound on it for us. But, you know, the beautiful thing about a collaborative effort like a play or like a movie, you know, I often hear people say, well, you know, that's just the movie, and I prefer the book. The book, you know, and yeah, books are wonderful. Books are, you know, literature is an art form, and it's beautiful. It's inspiring. However, that doesn't diminish the collaborative effort that it takes amongst hundreds of artists, literally hundreds of artists, it takes to make a movie. Or, you know, maybe that many it takes to make a Broadway play, you know, from the costume designer to the, you know, the music director and all the effort that goes into the set and just everything to create an event that gives somebody, the creation of the event is an experience, but it also gives someone in the audience an experience as well. An experience of not being them for a minute, you know,
right.
Of being someone else for a moment, relating to a character and identifying with a character and becoming that character for a moment in time and just forgetting yourself for a minute. And that's such an invaluable service in itself if you can achieve that for a person. And I know I love movies for that very reason. If I want to get away from my daily troubles, I go to a movie because that really gets me away from my world for a minute, for a couple hours or whatever. And sometimes the experience is so profound, I never forget it. I mean, you know, and the same with books and the same with plays and the same with anything that gives us that experience. So, you know, I just love that about the dramatic art. I really do. And I so take to heart your insight about a collaborative effort. So, what's the play about, and what's your plan? I know you would like to launch it at the summer conference.
Sure. So I'm working on a play, and the goal is to produce it in some form at IC14, which is almost to the day a year from now. Mm. And
goodness,
so
yeah. That'll go quickly. Won't it? 52 little weeks, 12 little months.
Oh my gosh, don't remind me.
You took the summer off to write it, right? Isn't that right? You took the whole summer off just to finish writing it.
Exactly. So, yeah, just a little bit of background on this play. You know, as I mentioned, I got a degree in playwriting, but after I graduated from college, I did a number of creative undertakings, and I worked on some shorter plays, and I had a group of three that I was writing musicals with for a number of years. And I got to a point where I realized that if I'm going to write a play, I really want it to be something that I stand behind, because, you know, there's always going to be critics. That's the way it works. If you get to the point of somebody actually seeing the thing, then there's going to be a whole range of responses, and some positive, some negative, some, you know, that will probably provide important insight. But at the end of the day, I really wanted to feel like if I was putting something out there, that regardless of the response to it, that I felt in some way that I had done something fulfilling from my own perspective, something that felt worthwhile. And so that if it, whether response is positive or negative, that I felt comfortable with my own relationship to the play. And so I really hadn't written very much as a result for the past few years, because I didn't feel like there was a project that I felt connected to and that I felt compelled to tell. And I was asked at the last international conference in 2011 if I would consider writing a play to be performed in 2014. And I said I would think about it. And then at one of our youth and young adult conferences in Los Angeles, and I think this was mentioned at the summer study session, actually, by Liz Craig. She referred to one of the exercises that we did there. But, you know, those lovely papers about the apostles where they talk about each of their characteristics, their strengths, their weaknesses, their relationship to Jesus, what they most admired about him, and even in some cases their nickname in the apostolic corps, and, you know, just these lovely details of character, which, of course, as a playwright, I find so compelling. Well, so we
Sadler found them almost to be psychological profiles. As a psychiatrist, he was intrigued by that. It won him over to finally, you know, believe in the Urantia teachings. He was a big skeptic. But, yeah, I can imagine how that's interesting to you as a playwright.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, and I can see how it would be interesting to him, too, from his perspective.
Yeah.
So I found that to be a really amazing sort of just breakdown of ways to consider a character. And so we took that format at our conference and we applied it to ourselves. So we thought about, well, what are our strengths? What are our weaknesses? What do we admire most about Jesus? What would be our nickname? You know, we even took it that far. But one of the key questions we asked was, you know, looking at that, an essential point of information that they provided in the Urantia book was how each of the apostles uniquely contributed to the group, and based on their strengths and weaknesses, what role they played. And so that was something that we thought about most deeply was, okay, well, if we have this revelation here and we want to be of service to it, you know, what's a unique way that each of us can be of service? And that was, gosh, I don't know, a year and a half ago, maybe more. And that was the point at which I committed to myself and to that group of people who was there. I said, you know, I've been saying that I'm not going to write another play until it's one that I really stand behind. And I've been asked to write something for an international conference of Urantia book readers, and I'm going to do it. And so I committed to doing it. And then in typical fashion, of course, proceeded to not do it for a number of months. And got to the point of realization when I found myself, you know, making plans to start divinity school in the fall, that this was the time. I had this summer to really finish up a first draft, at least, so that over the next 9 months or so, I can bring together that collaborative team that I've talked so much about to bring it to life. So all of that to say, I am writing a play about Ruth, Jesus's baby sister, and her extraordinary relationship to her father brother. And I want this to be a play for families. And that's very much related to my experience of growing up with the Urantia book and its teachings, and how meaningful it was to me to have adults in my life trying to present the teachings in a way that would be understandable to someone who's, you know, 8, 9, 10 years old. And Ruth, I find to be just a phenomenal character in the book, given that she was, you know, not only the youngest child of Jesus' brothers and sisters, but that she was also a girl living in a time when, you know, girls weren't even allowed to go to school. And the fact that she was the only member of Jesus' earth family who believed unswervingly in his mission and his divinity throughout his entire life and her entire life. You know, she outlived him, of course. And I want to tell her story because I think that there's some really valuable messages and lessons in it about loyalty and the relationship of loyalty to faith, and about family life. You know, we don't have very many depictions in the world right now of Jesus as a father and a brother in the most literal sense, you know, as
mm-hmm.
as someone who is leading a family. And I really want to, of course, you know, this is just my one contribution to what I'm sure will be many, many, many more creative undertakings as the Ranch book becomes more known. But I feel that to be able to tell Ruth's story to an audience of families and hopefully in a way that could be appealing to people even who haven't read the Urantia book, because ultimately, you know, they were a family like any other family. They had extraordinary circumstances and an extraordinary member of their family, but they were a human family and they faced many of the challenges that we do. So I am looking forward to finishing up this draft and then seeing what happens with it. But it's definitely going to be a musical. It's structured around 7 songs. And And it's really intended to be something that kids will enjoy and hopefully get something out of. So.
Well, so tell us a little bit more about the process of doing that, because that's got to be, I mean, if you're not inspired to do something, I can imagine how daunting this is and why you kind of back-burnered this kind of a project for so long. But as you get into it, how do you find yourself bringing it to life on the one hand, but how do you find it coming alive as you're working on it? What can you describe? I'm sure we've got at least one budding playwright, if not more, in the audience. And so imagine, you know, what is that process? If somebody was asking you, what are you going through as you write a character? What does that feel like to you as you're going through and writing your play?
It's a pretty amazing experience.
Wow,
because,
it would be.
Yeah, I mean.
Now, don't tell us it's too deep for words, because you're a wordsmith.
Well, to start out, just, you know, for the budding playwright in the audience, or, you know, for anyone, this is, in my experience with writing plays, I find it extremely difficult. You know, I'm not sitting here just being inspired all the time. You know, I find it to be a very, very challenging process, and I always do, no matter what I'm writing. You know, I think every once in a while I'll get this expectation of, well, maybe this time it'll be different, and it'll just all flow, and it'll be so easy and so natural. And by and large, I find it to be very hard. I also, with this project, however, find it to be so far extremely satisfying, because it's allowing me and actually forcing me, you know, to really delve into the study of the Urantia book in a whole new way. You know, it's one thing to read it in order to know the facts of, for instance, Jesus' life on earth, and then to, you know, contemplate and meditate on ways to apply his life and teachings. But it's a different experience to really take the information that the book provides and to consider it as these sort of wonderful little moments of scenes that it's been my responsibility in this effort to expand upon, you know. And that's, of course, going to be only one interpretation and one creative perspective on these various moments. But, you know, you take, for instance, the moment of Joshua and Ruth sitting together in the boat, you know, when she was a young woman and she had this secret visit with him for 45 minutes or something, and the book says nothing about what they talked about, but it tells
wow,
them that it
it's
happened.
Almost like they're leaving it for playwrights to invent it, huh?
Yeah, exactly.
That's great.
You know, so there's, because Ruth is, she's mentioned throughout the Jesus papers, but not not to the degree that many of the other characters are. You know, there's relatively little about her, but that which they say, I just find to be so potent, you know, because they'll have one sentence, but it'll be, you know, her saying to the rest of her family that she hopes her brother would rather die before he let those wicked Pharisees stop his preaching. You know, it's like you get these one-liners from her. It's like, well, wow, a lot was clearly going on with her.
Well, Angie, we have a caller who's been holding for a while, and I'd like to put him on. I don't know if he's got his hand up, essentially, and he's calling in from London.
Great.
So I'd like to put him on real quick, and then and we can continue on. Ruth is definitely a hero for me from the Arantia book, and one of the things that stands out, and I'll put Sean on real quick here, but is that Jesus was the only father she ever knew, the only father she ever knew. And she may hold that distinction in the universe of universes. I don't know. I mean, that's an interesting distinction. He was the only father she ever knew. And so he was thoroughly her father. And whatever conclusions she came to, he was certainly instrumental in influencing, you know, her and guiding her ideas and thoughts. So here's Sean from London. Let's see. Sean?
Hi,
Sean,
Paula. How are you?
Holding. Thank you.
How are you?
Hi, Sean.
So long. So, and we're
Hi,
good.
Sean.
Hi. Thanks very much for taking my call. I'll keep it brief because I've been really enjoying listening to the interview with Angie, and I don't want to take up too much of your time. The reason I wanted to call in is, interestingly, my 10-year-old daughter, whose name is Ruth, has been asking me a lot of I know. She's been asking me lots of questions about the Arantia book. We've actually just come back from holiday, and she knows that I've been reading it, and she's been asking me lots of questions. We've actually read a bit of it together, and she got it very, very quickly. I think she understood it probably more quickly than I do. So my question for Angie is whether you have any, or either for Andre or Paula for that matter, is whether you have any question, any advice in terms of how you can introduce the Arantia book to a young child, not forcing it on them, but, you know, as Ruth has shown an interest, any tips on, you know, guiding her in the study, that sort of thing.
Well, first of all, I'd like to offer you to send you the Young Child's Guide to the Arantia book, written by our friend, and Angie and Andre all know Mary Eben very well, and I think her kids kind of grew up with Angie in our community in Boulder, our Arantia community, and Mary specifically wrote that book for young children because she had two young children at the time, and it's beloved within the Arantia movement, and I'd be happy to send that to you, Sean. So that would be, there's my offering right there, and we'll see what
Great.
Angie has to say.
Excellent. Thank you. Thank you, Paula.
You bet. Send me your address,
by
the way.
That is a wonderful resource.
I will do.
Yeah, that's
Angie, I think it would come to you, that question, almost in the sense of, so what did you find worked and what didn't work in terms of what adults and your parents did? And clearly a lot of it worked. They were extraordinarily wise in what they were doing. So that's what I hear in Sean's question. What might you offer?
Well, I can say that I think, you know, as you know, what's so remarkable about the book's teachings is that there is this central idea of religion as a personal experience. And so to hear that your daughter is asking these questions, which are presumably coming from her experience, you know, the questions she's asking are coming to her out of genuine curiosity and something that comes to mind in terms of the way that Mary and Joseph raised Jesus. And, you know, what they say in the book is that they were just so loyal in always doing everything that they could to answer his questions, even though he was asking them constant questions, and some of them were probably far beyond what they were able to thoroughly answer. But I think simply the act of doing your best to answer her questions goes a long way.
Right.
You know, and of of taking them seriously, you know, and treating them with the same level of sincerity that she's offering them. And I'm sure you do that. So that's probably not a particularly insightful thing to say, because that might just be instinctively what's already going on. But I guess to absolutely encourage the continuous asking of those questions by really taking the time to address them as fully as you can. And, you know, then as time goes on, depending on how you feel comfortable with presenting some of the teachings of the book, I mean, I personally, I think, benefited from having these simple, you know, and having resources like the one that Paula offered, you know, simple snippets of wisdom that you can then have a discussion about. You know, it doesn't have to be something that you know the answer to and she doesn't. It's something you can, in addition to saying, here's what I think, you know, you also offer, well, what do you think about that?
Yeah, that's interesting. That's the tack we've been taking, because when we've been discussing it, we've sort of said, well, you know, we've tried to work together to sort of almost like have our own little study group between the two of us to try and work out the answers to various, you know, various concepts, various points that are raised in the Arantxa book. So, yeah, I think that's a good point that you just made.
My daughter, May Lee, who grew up with the Arantxa book as well, and my older children, Jean and Nathan, did also. And I love to give them concepts, and one of the favorite concepts, of course, is that God is with you, God lives in your heart, and that you can talk to him anytime you like.
Yeah.
He's always there for you. He's always on. He's always listening. He always cares. And little May one day, I don't know how she, you know, I probably things that I had said drew her to this conclusion. She was about 4 years old. I was taking her to the babysitter, and she was sitting in the back seat of the car, and we're just driving along, and she pipes up and says, "So, God's up in heaven, but God's in my heart."
Oh, fantastic.
And my heart melted when she said that. And I said to her, you know, honey, some people live their whole life and don't figure that out.
Yeah. Yeah, she's nailed it there at 4 years of age.
Yeah. So, but, you know, again, and it's, to me, it's a lifelong desire of mine to help people realize how deep children are spiritually, and how able they are to understand spiritual concepts.
Yeah.
We withhold that and get them to cut and paste. We do them a tremendous disservice, I think.
Yeah.
They're
yeah.
spiritually deep, and they're open. They're not indoctrinated, so to speak, to shut
That's
down.
Right.
And Angie, I love what you said about asking, well, what do you think about that? And creating an environment where the child feels free to ask numerous questions, any question, the sky's the limit, because Jesus himself gave us permission to do that. He said, seek, ask, knock. And, you know, the great mistake, I think, that religionists make oftentimes is to, you know, discourage questioning because they don't have the answer.
Right.
Yeah, and I guess I can just corroborate all of that, Sean. You know, I've raised three kids, and you know, those questions, they don't always come up very often. But when they come up, I found that what was helpful was having studied the teachings myself well enough and the life and teachings of Jesus well enough to have adopted some of the attitudes that are portrayed in the book. Like, Jesus was always willing to talk to the little children. So that's something that became a value for me early on in my reading of the Arantxa book, was that it wasn't just that. It was sort of something I kind of already realized, but when you read something like that, all of a sudden it's like, okay, it's like a spotlight has been shined on that value. And I'm sure we all have had that experience with the Urantia book. The Urantia book isn't necessarily revealing everything new to everybody that finds the Urantia book. Part of the reason we find it is that some of what the Urantia book is revealing has already been revealed to us by our thought adjuster. Certainly not all of what the Urantia book is revealing, but the point being that that's how we resonate with it. That's how your daughter gets to the questions that she's getting to.
Right.
And, you know, so as you just maintain both openness and willingness, and as much as there may be some trepidation on the part of us parents at times of, God, I hope I don't screw this up, especially when all of a sudden a question comes out of the blue,
yeah,
and you realize this is a golden opportunity.
Yeah.
It's a golden moment. God, don't lose it. Don't screw it up. And
don't
and,
let me lose it.
Yeah. That's right. But it really becomes more a matter of the realization of, for one thing, how much your daughter loves you to be asking you such a question. Two, you know, what a wonderful opportunity is to just begin to share the seeds of whatever that concept is.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And then just watch that seed as it develops, as Paula described wonderfully with May, how all of a sudden, boom, all of a sudden that concept blossoms into a new realization that they then reveal to you.
Exactly.
Out of the mouths of babes.
Yeah.
It's just
marvelous. Yeah. Well, listen, thanks very much for taking the call, and I won't take any more time, but Paula, I will email you my address, and if you'd be good enough to send me the booklet that you referred to, I would very much appreciate that.
I'll be happy to do that for you, Sean.
Okay. Thanks very much,
Sean,
guys.
Marvelous to hear from you across the
you
pond.
Too.
Absolutely.
Thanks for holding.
Thank you, Sean.
Okay, speak to you soon. Bye-bye.
Okay,
bye-bye.
Sean. Bye for now. So it's always a delight to hear from Sean.
And,
absolutely.
Can't wait to meet his daughter.
Yeah, I can't wait to meet him, too. And hopefully, you know, it reminds something he said made me think that I sure hope, Angie, that we can film this play and make it broadly available to families with young readers all over the world, because I think it just has so much value to do it. The whole undertaking is tremendously valuable, and I know that you had just done a successful fundraiser so that you could take the summer off to write the play. I wonder, are you still open to raising some funds? Do you still need money to accomplish that, or are you good?
That's very sweet of you to ask. I think the next phase will be actually later on, probably in the early part of 2014, when we're actually getting ready to produce the play. And at that point, there will hopefully be a team, and that's one thing that I am actively looking for, is for people who are interested in being involved in helping to put on the production. So if anyone listening in is interested in that, I would definitely love to hear from you. I'll be meeting all kinds of talent in all the areas that are necessary in order to create a piece of theater. So in addition to bringing together a team, I think in the early part of 2014, we may be looking to raise some more funds for the production itself. I'm taken care of for the summer in terms of this writing residency I'm doing, thanks to really just humbling generosity from our community. I think there were over 100 people who donated to help make this be a reality for me this summer, and I'm just absolutely touched and grateful. So I'm not asking for anything else for myself at the moment, but come early next year, we'll definitely be thinking about bringing it to life and what kind of resources we might need.
So where can somebody write or go if there's a website where if they want to throw their hat in and help you out with the production or be apprised of fundraising needs as they come up. Is there some place that they can sign up for that?
I think the easiest place to send people to would probably be the Facebook page, because that has links to everything else. And so there's a Facebook page called The Story of Ruth, and that's the page where I kept people apprised of the fundraiser. The fundraiser was through a platform called Indiegogo, but I'll be keeping people informed about not only the fundraising but also the progress of the writing and the production on that Facebook page. So that's probably the easiest place to go, and anyone can join that group of that page. And another thing that's been wonderful about it is that I've been a member of the New York Society, Your Antibook Society of Greater New York, and they were my fiscal sponsor for the project, meaning that they granted me their nonprofit status so that anybody who donates to the project will get their donation tax exempt. And it's sort of a society contribution to making this play happen. So I was grateful for that too, and that will continue to be true throughout the production process.
That's great. So yeah, if you haven't joined Facebook yet, I highly recommend it. That's where so many, it really is the essence of community and an easy place for people to meet online without going through a lot of trouble and to share their creative endeavors, like the story of Ruth. And so, you know, if you're not on Facebook yet and you'd like to join, it's not hard, and you'll be able to find out what Angie's doing and so many other great community offerings in your rancher community. It's a great way to connect with your rancher community. So I highly recommend it if you haven't joined yet. So
I've just put the link on the chat board, and essentially it's facebook.com/JesusandRuth, one word, FREF equals TS. And if you click on that, if you put that in, again, facebook.com/JesusandRuth, all one word, FREF equals TS, you'll get to the Story of Ruth page. There's a movie page about the Ruth of the Bible. And Angie's page is this one.
And I'll just add, you know, maybe this will be a segue as well, but you can also find the link to the fundraising page on the IC14 website. And that's a simpler link. That's just www.ic14.org.
Okay.
And then you can find it on one of the menus there. I think the name of the menu item might be New Play for Families, something along those lines. But I'll be making regular updates to that conference website as well. And, you know, as we get closer, there will be more information about the play along with every other aspect of the conference. So that's another place to go.
That's a great segue into every other aspect of the conference, which... you're getting a reputation for being pretty amazing, Angie, and you are also chairing the next International Conference of the Urantia Book Fellowship. And just a little history for our listeners, Urantia Book Fellowship, formerly Urantia Brotherhood, has been doing international conferences since 1967, and every 3 years, they're triennial. And as somebody who has served closely on every one since 1990, I know how much is involved in creating these events, and I know you started working on it 2 years ago, and it takes a full 3 years to bring it to fruition, and this year coming up is going to be the most intense. So thank you for taking that on. It's a huge responsibility, and I so appreciate it, and I know everybody else in the fellowship appreciates it. to have your young talent and your young perspective. What do you have in mind for IC International Conference 14?
Well, I'm really excited about it. It's going to be just the facts really quickly are that it's going to be in July of 2014, the 23rd to the 27th, and it's at the University of Massachusetts in Amherst, Massachusetts. And that's not to be confused with Amherst College. And the theme of the conference is Grow Godward. And I'm really excited about the program that we're putting together because it's essentially a celebration of the diverse paths that we each take, you know, each of us uniquely as we grow toward God. And so the program itself actually has six different tracks, and each of those tracks provides a different point of entry. So one of them is study the book, you know, and that's the in-depth study track, and that's being led by our education committee, and, you know, will really be an opportunity for those who gain deep satisfaction from in-depth study. And then we have a track called Living the Teachings, and that's going to be all about the application of the teachings in our lives. We have a track called Bring the Family, and that's dovetailing with a really exciting children's program that's being put together. And there's a track for the Truth Seekers, which is a meanings and values curriculum for teenagers, and there will be a wonderful teen program at the conference, but then we're also going to be applying some of that curriculum for adults, for those attending the conference, if they're interested in learning about it. And then we have a track called Serve with Love, which is all about service and outreach, and a track that's called Engage the World, and that involves both international and interfaith undertakings. And all of this put together, you know, each of those tracks has a different chair and a different group of people responsible for bringing wonderful content to the conference. But as a conference goer, you'll have your pick to participate in any and all across tracks throughout the week. So I'm excited about that because it's meant I've already gotten to work with a really extraordinary team of people who are doing that thing I said I love, which is applying all of their unique creative talent to bring to the table. And you know, above and beyond that, I think, you know, I grew up going to conferences, and that was something that I always found really enriching as a child, and especially just to have the real experience of seeing this community that I was part of. You know, we're all spread out all over the country and the world, and it's pretty unusual to get to be surrounded by hundreds of other people who have discovered this book and are trying to apply it in their lives. So I'm really trying to glean wisdom from all of the people like you, Paula, who have been so involved in creating these events for years and years, and to take... To try to, you know, be a sponge to take in that wisdom and to involve people in this process who have a lot of experience, and then to also involve people in the planning and execution who, like me, are of the younger generation and, you know, who might have new ideas, some of which are tested, some are untested. But, you know, I'm really trying to be intentional about creating partnerships. And, you know, I've been very lucky to have really strong mentors in my life and also in this planning process for the conference. And So as much as possible, I'm creating mentorship models in the leadership leading up to the conference so that there are younger people who are partnering with those who have done some of this before and trying to learn from them while also bringing, you know, there are new ideas to the table. And so the vision for it is one of really what I hope to be a sort of generating and regenerating experience for those who attend. And I really encourage anyone who's listening in to try to make it. And, you know, we're going to be launching registration in September and trying to put together packages for that registration that address a variety of preferences and needs and financial situations to really try to make the conference accessible. So it should be fun.
It always is.
Yeah, it should be. It's just 5 hours and 52 minutes away from me by car.
Hey,
you could drive there.
That's just for you.
I could drive there, yeah. And I know my buddy Reed Hubbard might be listening in, and he's even closer there in Morgan, Vermont. And so is our dear friend Kay Nussel, who's in Montpelier, Vermont. She's probably a stone's throw, just probably 2.5-3 hours away. So,
well, and
there you
know,
go.
Road trips.
And Lou Bartholomew is right over there in New Hampshire, and so many others.
Well, and so it's back on the East Coast. We try to move it around. We've had it on in the West for the last two times, so it's nice that it's back in the East again. Gives a whole different group of people a chance to go, if they choose to, I'm just so excited about it, Angie, and I think it's just going to be a wonderful offering. And what you mentioned about the experience that you have there, I shared a little story last weekend about Andre's sister saying the minute we got here to the conference, my brother's head popped and light came out. And it's,
honestly.
You know, literally, I mean, it because she was describing to me how excited he was to get there and how much it meant to him to be. And you know, it's something that we take for granted. As Urantia book readers, because the book is so powerful and it changes you, and you want to talk to people about it because it opens up new vistas and new ideas and new concepts for you, and you just it just fills your heart. You just want to talk to somebody about it. And if you don't have anybody to talk to about the Urantia book when you're reading it, it's very difficult. And thankfully, the Internet has opened up a lot of opportunities for people to share ideas and talk to other people about the Urantia book. But there's nothing like going to a conference and meeting other Urantia book readers from around the world and around the country, and sitting with them at breakfast, or, you know, having a moment to sit down and drink a cup of coffee and just share, get to know them. It's really an amazing thing. And that's, you know, and then to share worship together, you know, a little story from the summer study session, which every year that the fellowship doesn't do an international conference, the 2 years in between, we do a summer study session. We've had it at Techni, Illinois, the last couple of times. And John Callahan was there. He attended last week. It was just last week. And at one point, there's always a group worship, and I personally love to worship with a group. I find it to be, you know, I can worship with myself any day as a Urantia and as somebody who believes in the revelation, and of course I do, but there's something about just contemplating that great eternal reality of the Heavenly Father at the center of all things with a group of people who know Him and love Him and just are contemplating Him too. And group worship is profoundly beautiful in my opinion, but some people don't really get into it. They don't like it much. And I've had some complaints about it. And John wasn't sure if he liked it much or not, but he was listening to we were engaged in group worship, and Bobby Dreyer created a wonderful little video that it has Louis Armstrong singing I Think to Myself It's a Wonderful World. And the whole group spontaneously burst into song.
Huh.
And it touched John Callahan so much. He came up to me afterwards and said, you know what? I didn't think that group worship had much value at all until this whole group spontaneously started singing. And he said, I get it. And he got all choked up. And it was so touching because that really is what it is. It's not just, you know, obviously we can get together and be of one mind. But when we worship together, we are of one heart. We are one heart, and our heart touches the great divine heart. We forget that there is a great divine heart to touch, and that's what worship is. He touches our heart, and we touch his back. And John got it. So it you know, that's another aspect of the internationals and even those summer conferences, is that worship aspect, and that's a beautiful thing too. And the entertainment and the music is exquisite at conferences. There's so many talented musicians.
Absolutely, yeah.
Well, for anyone who thinks that sounds pretty good, that they should know that Paula is in charge of worship at IC14. So it's going to be, I have no doubt, just really sublime.
It should be a wonderful time, wonderful occasion.
Joanne Weedman, yeah, is doing that with me.
Yeah,
so we'll have a grand, we'll touch the divine heart, I'm sure. Yeah, and, you know, we're down to our last half hour, and I'd like to give you also a chance to share your story about your decision to pursue a Master of Divinity at Harvard. I really enjoyed it when you told me this story. And what your goal is. And
absolutely.
You want to share a little bit about that?
Yeah, you've really piqued my curiosity with that too, because I'm sure a lot of people are wondering, okay, so what motivates someone to want to formalize their study that would lead them into ministry? And especially your choice, because you both applied and now have been accepted into?
Harvard Divinity School.
Harvard Divinity School, which, correct me if I'm wrong, that's not easy to get into, is it?
Well, I don't have any statistics on it, but I was definitely...
Okay, so that's not easy to get into, and that's quite a coup. So now a big question comes up, you know, Why go into divinity school, and why Harvard, and what is it that is part of why you're thinking it's going to be important to be both credentialed and to get what Harvard has to offer in terms of study?
Sure. Well, you know, we have this pretty profound idea in the Orange Book of religion being a personal experience. And as I have spent the last few years, especially with my peers living in New York City, I've just noticed more and more in my own experience what is also just statistically true in terms of the trends in this country, that people are more and more questioning or even rejecting organized religion, while in some cases preserving this idea of spirituality. And, you know, they've been talking about the rise of the nuns, N-O-N-E-S, you know, people who are religiously unaffiliated. The nuns. And at this point in my generation of people under 30, there's about a third of us who are identifying as spiritual but not religious. And I find that to be particularly interesting, just given this moment we're living in where our globe is more interconnected than it's ever been before. And I don't think that that's going to be reversing itself anytime soon. In fact, I think we're just going to get more and more interconnected. And so I think there's this experience people are having where when they're face-to-face with people who have a different religious affiliation or a different set of religious practices or experiences, and, you know, one institution is saying we're the chosen people and the other institution is saying no, we are, and this one is saying, well, no, you have to accept this or else, that a lot of people are just looking at that and saying, well, that's not for me, and how can that possibly be true when I'm encountering so much diversity just in my own daily life? And what does this organized religion has to do with the experience of personal encounter and what might be termed spirituality that I'm having. And so I got to the point where I started to feel like that idea from your answer book is just one that is so needed, especially among my generation, because I don't think the idea of spiritual but not religious is particularly helpful in trying to build an empowering community or spiritual unity among people who are striving to become the best versions of themselves. If you have a but not in your identity, you know, that's, I think, probably going to cause some stagnation, you know, when you're concerned with what you're rejecting. And so I feel like there's a moment here where it could be really helpful if we could replace what's being rejected with something new that could be adopted instead. You know, the idea that religion is actually the outgrowth of personal experience and spirituality as opposed to something that's imposed on top of it. And so I applied to divinity school because I felt like in order to try to go about helping in some way to share that idea and to develop it further, that I needed to first of all get a whole lot more education about religion. You know, it's funny, I have grown up with the Urantia book, of course, but my understanding of the world's religions is relatively limited. So I feel that I need to be conversant. I need to have the vocabulary and also the experience of learning some of these highest truths that we know are in the world's religions and that are very powerful. So I felt to learn more. I also felt and continue to feel that I need to find peers and partners and mentors who are coming at this question from different perspectives, you know, who don't have the Urantia book in their lives and yet who are arriving at insights that would be able to combine with mine and hopefully build on our collective insights. And then, you know, Andre, as you alluded to, I also feel like if I'm going to go about doing this work, I need to have some credibility. And, you know, I think that it will be important for me to have these credentials. It's one thing for me to go try to interview 1,000 people about what spirituality means to them as Angie Thurston, you know, someone who has a religion that no one's heard of. and hopefully, you know, it would be a slightly more conducive situation if I were to say, you know, I'm writing a master's thesis at Harvard Divinity School and this is the subject I'm interested in talking with you. So, you know, we'll see how it evolves, but that's the intention that I'm going in with. And in the course of 3 years, I'm sure, you know, maybe we can follow up at some point along the line. We'll find out how it's panning out. But I'm really, really excited.
We'd love to, because, you know, I can see this as being something that comes, I mean, already on the board, there's a wide variety of comments. And, you know, some of the commentary is decidedly, is it really necessary, you know, to have a credential, you know, to go and you know, preach the gospel or you know, we don't, you know, the idea is that we don't administer, you know, God's love. We you know, minister God's love, and the apostles were all unlearned, and there's all of that kind of thing. So, you know, those questions all kind of surround that. So what is your understanding of, besides, of course, the additional credibility, it's going to give you a lot of different experience. So how do you answer people that may be coming from that standpoint where they really have an aversion to the idea of credentialed ministers or people that are that have been, say, ordained by an institution or have just been schooled in religion somewhere?
Well, to me, a school is really about the people in it. And the reason that I am particularly excited about Harvard is that it's a place that draws a lot of really bright minds and really curious students. And my hope is that by engaging with those minds and those fellow students, that we'll be able to collaborate in ways that I can't yet foresee, but that I think will cross disciplines. And for instance, you know, by enrolling in the Divinity School, I'm going to be able to take classes in the Law School and the Business School and the Kennedy School. And, you know, I have a particular curiosity, given the aversion of my peers, in many cases, to organized religion. I have curiosity about the ways that the secular sphere is incorporating ideas that I would consider spiritual, but not calling them religious. So I'll give one example is at Google, they have something, I think they call it flex time, where each of their employees is given 10% of their time, I believe it is, where they can do whatever they want. And I think that I could be wrong about this, but I think maybe whatever they come up with during that flex time is then owned by Google. That may or may not be true, but it's been an extremely successful concept on the part of the company because they have these extraordinary, brilliant people working for them. And they then, some of the best ideas that have come out of Google have been because they've allowed their employees to innovate on their time. And so one of their employees, I think he was the 17th engineer that Google ever hired, totally brilliant guy named Che Meng Tan, he decided, well, if I have 10% of my time to do whatever I want, I think I want to create world peace.
Wow.
And so he said, okay, how am I going to create world peace? And, you know, I'm obviously paraphrasing here, but essentially he brought together some of the best people he could think of to help him come up with the idea for a class, and he called it Search Inside Yourself. And, of course, that's a pun on Google being a search engine. But it's a class for Google employees on mindfulness and emotional mastery. And he teaches it, and he's now creating a leadership institute based on it because it's been so extremely popular that every time it's offered, it sells out instantly, and thousands of Google employees have now gone through this class. And it teaches things that are, you know, as nitty-gritty as sending mindful emails, for instance.
Right.
You know? And anyway, I just use that as an example to say I think that, you know, it maybe it was glib of me to say, you know, I just want credentials or something. More what I'm referring to is being in an environment where there is access to resources across disciplines and, you know, where I can bring the Urantia book and do my best to apply some of its concepts that go, you know, go beyond religion. I mean, the Urantia book is revelatory in all areas. And I really feel that, you know, given my particular path so far, that this is a possible place where I could be of service and learn from people and strive to develop a kind of a harmonizing idea, you know, one that would not pit science, philosophy, and religion against each other, but rather learn from science, philosophy, religion, and all of these many disciplines in order to try to be of real service to a generation that I think is really, really searching.
You know, I love what you're saying, Angie, because you have every reason an opportunity to pursue this path, and you're going for maximum results, and you know exactly how to get them, and what it's going to take, and you're a realist in that respect. You're absolutely right. The world is impressed by credentials, and if you want to have a maximum impact on people in the world, then you will go down that path, and because you will, that will open doors for you. But more than that, what occurs to me, and I know your intentions and your heart, you really are going for maximum impact and service. What comes to mind is the Greek philosopher mentioned in the Urantia book, Rodin, and talking about wealth. He says, you know, you can hardly expect to get wealthy if you don't get into the channel of wealth. And mm-hmm. What you just said about, you know, going to Harvard Divinity reminds me that you can't have an impact on a generation of thinkers unless you get into the environment where they are. You have to go where they are. And you will, you know, and I know you're guided to this, you know, God's gumshoe on the board when we asked you why you did it, he simply wrote, because you were called. And he went to Unity Cemetery, Seminary, he said that was the best 2 years of his life. He posted that on the board. He was called to that, and you've been called to this, and you will be in essentially one of the most marvelous think tanks on earth for religious thinkers.
When you said you'd have access to the Kennedy School and Harvard Law and the Harvard School of Business, and I just imagined Alice walking down this room, this hallway with all these doors and a key in her hand, you know, ready to open up to any all these
exactly.
magical doors.
Yeah, well, and don't get me wrong, I definitely expect it to be the most challenging 3 years of my life, no doubt.
Sure.
And
sure.
I don't just mean the academics. I mean, I think, you know,
the intercourse,
what's that?
With your involvement with the people that'll be there will be challenging. Probably it'll be challenging in every way.
Yes, exactly. And I think undoubtedly I will end up growing as a result, you know, just being in the position where from the very beginning, you know, when I went to look at school as a prospective student, I made sure that I went to the office hours of the dean. And then I went and sat down and I told him, you know, briefly what I hoped to do. And I made sure that in his office I said the word Urantia book, you know, and that this was the text from which my belief system originates. And, you know, I wanted to make sure before I go there that, you know, at least I wasn't going to be thrown out of my ear for that, because I really had no idea. You know, and as it happens, Harvard was one of the few divinity schools I could find where the field work that I am going to do while I'm there is, it can be in a variety of different fields. Many divinity mm-hmm. schools, it's kind of understood that your field work will be in a church, you know, that you'll be pastoring or apprenticing. And I think mine is probably
going to be... Isn't that amazing,
huh? Yeah,
that's what an amazing kind of. Most schools have that. It's almost like saying most divinity schools have the blinders on, and you found one that has taken the blinders off.
Well, I think, you know, divinity school is a Protestant idea, so it's not so surprising that they would assume
mm-hmm.
that they were going about training ministers and that those ministers would be Christian. But Harvard has at the core of their curriculum for divinity school the idea of pluralism, you know, the idea that we live
yeah.
in a religiously plural world and that it's our responsibility to be learned ministers. And so it's actually built into their curriculum that you have to study, you know, they still assume, of course, that you have a religious tradition, you know, but
mm-hmm.
they require that you study at least one tradition outside of your own, or else you can't graduate. And, you know, there's things like that. I mean, I heard one definition of ministry while I was there considering application, where they said, consider ministry to be the application of your gift to the needs of the world. You know, and by that definition, you could call almost anything ministry. So I
think,
you know, I've heard that they walk that talk, and I'll find out for myself pretty soon.
Yeah. Well, we're in our last 10 minutes, and I want to just station identify once and say that you're listening to Blog Talk Radio. This is the Cosmic Citizen. And our show today has been with Angie Thurston, What Baby Ruth, IC-14, Yayas Have in Common. And my, what a wonderful, wonderful hour and 50 minutes it's been so far. So in these last 9 minutes, Paula, what are your burning questions?
Nice lob, pal.
Yeah, did you like that?
No. Well, you know, Angie, I just wanted to share with you what somebody on the board said. Suzanne, who comes often and frequently to the Cosmic Citizen, she said, it encourages me to consider what good hands the Urantia Book Revelation will be in the next generation. And that's my experience. I mean, you know, being with you guys last week at the summer study session, all the young people, Liz, Craig, our, the Youth and Young Adult Committee, and to the youth and young adults who weren't there, my hat's off to all of you guys, Tavo and Jeff, and you're just doing a great job, and I want you to know that if there's anything I can do to help support you in your efforts to come together as a community and as a generation to carry the torch into the future, I consider it a tremendous privilege and honor to do so. And you know, I just appreciate the caliber of, you know, it was great to have you guys there to see Liz, you know, every day, because I brought my granddaughter and I brought my daughter to the conference. And Liz Craig would say to me and Ella every day, so what study are we going to today? What workshop are you guys going to do? And she literally got them thinking about looking at the program and deciding what sounded interesting to them. And they got very involved with the curriculum and ended up loving it. And I know they have actually contributed. May Lee and Liz did a workshop last year, and I know they've contributed to the program. And it's great because of something we said earlier, you know, what comes out of the mouths of babes. And from my experience, my 15-year-old granddaughter is a babe, but she's so deep and profound to me. And I, you know, the Urantia Book has taught me this, if it has taught me nothing, that every generation brings something to the table, something that the last generation did not have and could not bring. And that is evolution. That's a given. We should count on it. We should absolutely have faith in it and count on it and honor it. And while sometimes it's hard for the older generation to do that, we need to, because this generation coming up is marvelous. And
yes,
they're going to take this thing forward in ways that we never dreamed possible, with dedication and commitment and devotion. And that does thrill me. That gives me hope. And I know that sometimes young people get confused and they lose their way. And Angie, you said, you know, there's a generation of seekers, they're searching, and I want to be there to help them, to help that process. And I do too, you know, and I want them to help me as well, because they have something to bring that I've never seen, and I want to see it. So It's a mutual admiration and a love fest. What can I say? I try to see the beauty of that. Go ahead, Angie. I'm sorry.
I was just going to say, you do so much to support us, and us, you know, just sort of speaking for the young people that I've gotten to know in the last couple of years who read the Urantia book and are trying to live it. And that's, you know, one area that we haven't touched on too much, but has just been really thrilling for me over the last couple of years that I've been serving on the Youth and Young Adult Committee, to get to know more and more young readers of the Urantia book, and to have that experience you're describing, Paula, of getting to know my own generation, really, and mm-hmm. and getting to watch it come into its own a little bit, and to be part of that process is deeply thrilling for me. And you know, every single person, it's remarkable being that our community is relatively small, perhaps that just increases my appreciation. But every new contact that I make, every new connection with a Urantia book reader or with anyone, I mean, as I've been preparing for divinity school, I've got to say, I've been using the metaphor, it's like I've opened a faucet. Like I just tell somebody I'm going to divinity school, and suddenly I'm having a conversation with them that I've never had before. You know, this could be my friend of 20 years, you know, and we never touched on subjects of spirituality or religion before. And it's remarkable just to kind of bear witness to the insights that people have arrived at on their own. It's really,
right.
I mean, talk about giving hope for the future. You know, here I have the Urantia book sitting on my lap. So many people are just arriving at these truly profound ideas based on their own experience, you know.
Right.
And so I'm really looking forward to seeing what it'll mean to build the spiritual unity that, you know, I'm going to continue to focus on, you know, and this is for selfish reasons, of course, too, on getting to know and love and create opportunities for gathering all the young people who read the Urantia book and who really are, you know, trying to live Jesusonian lives based on its teachings. And then beyond that, I'm really excited to start being part of an expanding circle among my generation and across the board, to see what we can help to build for this next generation coming up here on Urantia.
Well, you truly are a bridge between the two, and that's amazing and so necessary. Andre, I know you wanted to say something.
No, I just want to, you know, it's occurring to me that, you know, on the Urantia Now site, which is part of where the Youth and Young Adult Committee communicates, there's stuff on emergent Christianity and the emergent movement in general, and it seems to me that that's going to be you know, just one aspect, but of you know, where your studies take you and everything else. It's just going to be so interesting to see where all of this leads. I think you've just developed a following, Angie. There are a lot of us very curious to see where things go, and we'll be watching with great interest.
Yeah.
Well, you probably won't be watching. I'll probably be calling you all the time. <for advice.
laughs> I'll be engaging you.
Yes, I will be engaging you too.
Oh, good. Thank you. And it will be a great pleasure to share this experience and, you know, and move forward into the future. You know, someone on the board, Dream Master, is just so welcoming you and your generation, and just for the remembrance and the beauty that you guys are bringing. So thank you to all our wonderful youths and young adults, and thank you, Angie, for being a leader in that community and for picking up that responsibility and carrying it the way you do. It's really inspiring.
Yeah.
Well,
yeah, it's wonderful to have seen that all grow.
Yeah. And so
anything you want to leave us with?
What's that?
We have about 30 seconds.
Okay. Well, just to say that I've been so blessed to be able to stand on on your shoulders and on the shoulders of so many from the generation and the generations that have come before mine. And I continue to really internalize that wisdom and to just be full of gratitude for that. And it's what empowers me as I take these next steps and enter this next chapter. So thank you, and I look forward to more.
Thank you, and we'll have you back, Angie. We'll get updates from you if you're willing to come back, and it'll be great
always
to hear how your progress is going.
Sounds like a plan.
Okay, honey. Thank you so much, and thanks to all of our listeners and to my dear friend and co-host, Andre Rodatis. And until next time, friends. Did you have something else to add, Angie?
Just wanted to say thanks to Angie. This was wonderful. It was just a treat. Seriously, besides Paula and I, you've got a big following. No pressure. Just we're loving just watching and seeing where you're going. And I agree with Paula. Anything you need, anywhere that we can be of help, by all means, ask.
You already are.
Okay, dear.
Well, thanks.
Love you, too, and have a great week coming up.
You, too.
Okay.
Yes.
And until next week, we'll just say bye for now.
Bye for now from the Cosmic Citizen. Bye-bye.
Bye.
You've been listening to The Cosmic Citizen, a radio program focused primarily on the study and discussion of the Urantia Book and its teachings. The Urantia Book is a religious text that claims to be written by angels and other superhuman personalities. If you are a Urantia Book reader or a spiritual seeker looking for new truth, we hope and pray you have been nourished and edified by our ministry. Please remember that the views expressed on this program do not reflect the official views and opinions of any Urantia organizations. There is no official interpretation of the Urantia Book. So all opinions expressed on this program exclusively reflect the personal biases of the hosts, guests, and callers who participate in these discussions. And remember, only a brave person is willing honestly to admit and fearlessly to face what a sincere and logical mind discovers.